This is McGuire on the Wire, brought to you by McGuire Sponsel. We are a national consulting firm aiming to provide facts, advice, and updates on the ever-changing world of tax law. This podcast will give you base-level information as well as high-level thought leadership on how to navigate these technical disciplines. At McGuire Sponsel, we provide unique services to our clients using an old-school, hands-on approach that is deeply respected within the CPA industry. Now stick around and listen to one of our experts. We're glad you're here.
Thank you for joining us for another installation of our podcast. Today we want to talk a little bit about the new tax bill that came out. As we're recording this, it has already passed the House and Senate and it has moved on to the President for signature. As many people know and many people are seeing right now, this tax bill has a lot of implications, whether you're just a employee somewhere, whether you're a business, no matter who you are in the U.S., this tax bill will affect you in some way or another. We don't want to get into too many of the details for the individual rates or the business rates or even really the implications of this. What we want to talk about is, as McGuire Sponsel works, how does it affect some of the areas in specialty tax? So when I refer to specialty tax, what I'm talking about is there are certain benefits out there for businesses in the U.S. to allow them to do certain things. And that could be anything from the research tax credit to depreciation law to historic tax credits and other things that are out there to incentivize businesses to do things in the U.S. that are beneficial to the U.S. in general. Now, obviously, with any big tax change, there's a number of changes, and some of them include areas like this, and we want to make sure that people are informed as to how these changes will take place. Now, anyone that listened to our discussion on the Senate bill knows that under the Senate bill, there were some questions on the research tax credit. The research tax credit didn't really change that much, but what happened is the Senate bill brought back this provision called corporate AMT. And by reducing the corporate tax rate to 20% and setting the corporate AMT rate at 20%, there was going to be a limited ability for corporations to utilize the research tax credit. Now, the research tax credit is just a tax credit that's out there for companies that are making things cheaper, better, faster, companies that are doing innovation, hiring engineers, or doing things to design or re-engineer processes within the U.S. So it was put out there to really help people grow those types of businesses, those businesses where people are actually spending money on that research and experimentation, get a tax credit that goes back and helps benefit that company. Now, what happened is under the final bill, the House and Senate worked together to make sure that they got rid of that corporate AMT provision. So the research tax credit is pretty much retained the way it's always looked. There's not really much of a change to the way the research tax credit will work in the future. There is one exception to that. Starting in 2022, there will be a change where the research tax credit, certain 174 eligible expenses, will have to be capitalized and amortized over 5 years. That's a change for where they are today. I will also point out that we're sitting here recording this in 2017, and we're going into the tax year 2018 relatively soon. That's still 4 years in the future. We don't necessarily know how any of this is going to look 4 years in the future. We have to look at where it is today. It would be important, if I were a corporation, to start looking at tracking those costs moving forward so that I'm ready for that 2022 change. However, I would not necessarily change what I'm doing in terms of the formulation of the research tax credit until we see that change move forward. So as I mentioned, the research tax credit in general doesn't change, and especially for the next couple of years, we'll see no real changes to that. Where some of the bigger changes are is in depreciation and cost segregation and other parts of depreciation law. Now, in order to understand some of this, it's important to know where the rates are going to be. Under this new reconciled rule, the top corporate tax rate is going to be 21%, and the top individual rate is going to be 37%. Now, for certain pass-through entities, there is a 20% deduction against business income. So in other words, business income is going to get an initial deduction of 20% before you calculate how your tax rate works. So if you make $1 million, you're really paying taxes on $800,000 if you're a business. Now, depreciation is a way that the government has always allowed people to recapture some of the expense of buying equipment. So what happens is, let's say you have a 5-year piece of equipment, the government allows you to depreciate that over 5 years, typically using a double declining balance. So you get to accelerate that depreciation into the first few years. So you get about 20% depreciation the first year, 32% the next year, and so on and so forth. Now, after 9/11/2001, the government brought in something called bonus depreciation. And that's ranged anywhere from 30% to 50%. It went up for 1 year as high as 100%. And the way that works is if you buy a $1 million piece of equipment that is typically depreciable over 5 years, if the bonus depreciation is 50%, you write half of it off up front. So if you buy a $1 million piece of equipment, you immediately deduct $500,000 and then you depreciate the other $500,000 over the 5-year period. Now, under this new law, for a 5-year period, there will be 100% bonus depreciation. That means that someone that goes out and invests in equipment for their business can immediately write it off over the first year instead of waiting for that 5-year recapture. Now, what's key to this position is that the IRS has always required that bonus depreciation be only for new property. So if you are a manufacturing company and you go out and you buy a press for your manufacturing floor, if that is a brand new press, you're the first person to ever use it, you got to deduct that immediately and write that off in 1 year. However, if you bought a used press, because maybe you're a startup company trying to save on the cost of equipment, maybe you're a company that's taking advantage of other businesses that maybe are liquidating some of their assets, if that equipment was used, it was not eligible for that bonus depreciation. Under these new rules, used equipment is also available for bonus depreciation. So if I go out and I buy that new press on my manufacturing floor, that press, I can write 100% of it off, whether that press is new to me or new in general. So it can be a used piece of equipment. Now, there's some limitation as we get into automobiles and everything. We're not going to go through the whole automobile conversation right now, but it is important to note that. Now, additionally, bonus depreciation comes up when we start talking about new property. If a company does a cost segregation study, they can look at a building, which is typically depreciated over 39 years, and move out anything that might be included in land improvements, which is a 15-year category, 5-year equipment, 7-year equipment, and different things within that building. Now, this is a traditional study that people have done for years. Now, what changes and makes this more beneficial is it used to be that if you were doing this on a new property, you got to access bonus depreciation. However, used properties, when someone went out and bought a used warehouse, they did not get to access the same benefit. Now, under these new rules, bonus depreciation will be available for used property. So someone that goes out and buys a warehouse, let's say they buy a warehouse for $5 million and they have a cost segregation study done on that $5 million warehouse, and they determine of that $5 million warehouse, 10% or $500,000 is related to the parking lot. The parking lot is bonus depreciable eligible property. So if they can take bonus depreciation on that parking lot and that parking lot's $500,000, they can write off that entire parking lot in year one. So this is a key benefit to companies that are going out and acquiring real estate over the next few years. And it's something that they will need to talk to a cost segregation professional to make sure they're able to access. Now, additionally, what Congress and the Senate did in this new bill is they adjusted 179 expensing. Now, what 179 expensing is very similar to bonus depreciation. Certain assets are eligible for immediate write-off under the Section 179 provision. And it's very similar to bonus depreciation. It has some overflow to bonus depreciation as well. But under this, they increased 179 expensing to $1 million. With a $2.5 million phase out. And what I mean with the $2.5 million phase out is you get to write off the first $1 million if you spend under $2.5 million on 179 eligible property. Once you spend a dollar more than $2.5 million, you reduce the amount eligible by a dollar for each dollar that you spend. So once you spend $3.5 million, you don't get any 179 eligible property. So if you buy $2 million worth of 179 eligible property, you get to write off $1 million. You capitalize $1 million. If you buy $3 million worth of 179 eligible property, you would only be able to 179 $500,000 of it, and so on and so forth. Now, the key portion here is a lot of people initially looked at this and said, well, if I get bonus depreciation, why do I care about 179 eligibility, especially if I can take bonus depreciation on used property? And one of the key things here is they changed 179 to include HVAC, roofs, security system, and fire protection systems that are placed in service after the building is originally placed in service. So if you are a taxpayer that owns real estate and you go in and put a new roof on your building, if it's under that $1 million threshold and you've spent less than your $2.5 million that year, potentially that roof is eligible for this 179 provision. Now, what is also important is, let's say you're a company that goes through a large renovation and you spend $5 million on that renovation, including a roof, including HVAC, including new equipment, everything else. You're going to have to look at all your 179 eligible property, which might include that roof and that HVAC, before you make that determination. So if you're going through this large $5 million expansion, there's a better chance you might hit that $2.5 million threshold, or even up to the $3.5 million, and you'll be phased out of the 179. So it's going to be important for taxpayers to look not only at the 179, but also go in and look at where they can go in and look at when something's a repair versus a capitalizable cost. So for those people that remember, a few years ago, the IRS came out with the repair maintenance regulations. And under that, they said that certain changes to roofs, for example, might not be capitalizable if they're not a betterment to the structural system. So if in the roof they put down just a membrane, that might not be a capitalizable expense. So if they did that $5 million renovation, let's say the roof was $500,000. If we go through the repair and maintenance regulations and we determine that that is all a repair, we don't have to include that with our 179 eligible expenses, which might then get us back down under the threshold and allow us to write off the HVAC system or something else. So whenever we're talking about these, this is a big bill, and that's just one example of when we need to look at this more holistically and not just look at the provisions that are under this bill, and we need to look at all of them. Now, finally on depreciation, I will point out that these rules do not change the lives of depreciable assets under the way that they were discussed under the Senate bill. Under the Senate bill, there was a question as to whether or not they should move real property, which is typically depreciated as 39-year for non-residential and 27.5-year for residential real property, down to 25 years for both. And they did not conform to that rule under this final bill. So under this final bill, we still have 39-year property and 27.5-year property. They did, however, combine and make one type of property for qualified restaurant property, qualified leasehold improvements, qualified retail property, which is a 15-year eligible property. So it's going to be important to look at those, but there's not much of a change in terms of how we catalog property. It's just a change in how we handle it once it gets cataloged. Now, finally, the other big change that I want to talk about today is under historic tax credits. Now, for those that don't know, the IRS has always, in recent years, had a tax credit out there for the certified rehabilitation of historic structures. And it was a two-tiered system. And if you went out and you had a structure that was listed on the National Historic Register and the renovation to it was certified as meeting the historic criteria, the credit was up to 20%. Now, there's certain criteria. You couldn't change too much of the structure. You had to spend more on your renovation than you had in your basis of your building and some other steps to make sure that you met these criteria. Now, there was also a reduced credit of only 10% of your qualified expenditures. However, that 10% credit did not require that it was a certified historic structure. It just required that the building was originally placed in service prior to 1936. Under these final rules, what happens is they get rid of the 10% credit and retain the 20% credit. So that means that someone that is looking at the historic tax credit and looking at the 20% credit will probably still be eligible, But someone that has a older property that does not want to go through the process of getting that certified and getting it listed on the National Historic Register, et cetera, is not going to be eligible for this credit. And that's going to be something that people have to look at. Now, I will point out that there is a phase out for that provision. So if someone is currently working on a rehabilitation tax credit under the 10% rules, they will have time to finish that, and it's not something they have to rush into too much. Now, finally, I do want to point out before I end, this gives us one opportunity that we have not had in a long time. We know that tax rates are going to drop in 2018. However, as we're recording this, we're at the end of 2017. That means we have not done our 2017 returns yet. If we can look at accelerating depreciation deductions and other deductions into 2017, this is giving us a short-term window where we might be able to capitalize on the differential in rates. So, for example, someone sitting on $1 million in deductions, if they can file a catch-up adjustment on a 3115, they can move those deductions into 2017, take them at their current tax rate, which if they're at the top marginal tax rate is pretty close to 40%, and save that as it moves forward into 2018. Even if they have to recapture some of those provisions, they'll be taking that recapture rate at a much lower rate. So it gives us a short-term window where we might be able to capitalize on some permanent tax savings where it's typically just a temporary or timing difference. Thank you for tuning in. If you have any questions about this or anything else, please feel free to reach out to your McGuire Sponsor representative. As we start seeing more of these things change, we will keep updating you through this and our other blogs and other media outreaches.
Thanks so much for listening to McGuire on the Wire. Have a question from today's episode or interested in our team covering another topic? Reach out to us at McGuire on the Wire at McGuireSponsor.com.